So what is this forward contract? It's a contract to buy a quantity of wool, but a date in the future, but they'd agree the price now. And they would also pay in advance. But they're not just that. They'd also talk about what sort of quality they wanted of the wool, and they'd also talk about the quantity of wool they wanted. And they'd also even talk about dressing the wool. By what we mean, they have a special man they brought in who would have a special comb, and he would look after the wool and make sure it was all well presented. And they'd also say where they wanted that wool delivered, okay, which port we want that delivered to, on which day. So they're very complicated and very precise documents. This is another one, but this time, this one's what's called an indenture. Now, some of you may have come across that word indenture, and it means, sort of today, it means contract, an indenture. You know, you could be an indentured, you can get an indenture to mean a contract. And why they're called indentures is an interesting thing, that's why I've shown you it, is because of the jagged line on the top. Okay, so the line up here. What that did, you wrote the contract twice, and then you cut it in half, so you could match the two contracts back together to show they were true contracts. Okay? Yeah? And you can see the little bits of writing that they've cut through, so they'd be an exact match. Now, why they're called indentures is because they said they looked like teeth. Yeah? Like dentures. We call dentures a false teeth in England, but denture means teeth. So they said they looked like teeth. Okay, so that's why these are indentures. And that's another indenture for another contract. And this is a translation of that contract. So what make you read it? I've got some details here. It's all in Latin, by the way. We have to be able to read Latin to study the medieval world. A lot of people say it's a dead language, but obviously it isn't, because you need it to read these medieval documents. You're not learning Latin here, I suppose. No, no. Okay. So the explanation, this one, is a contract made in 1242. And it's a one-year contract, so it's only a one-year forward contract. And it says it's buying all of the wool of your house for the following year. And it's two English merchants have bought this, despite their names, one being from Toulouse, Adam's from Shoreditch, nice London name. And they say how much they're going to pay for each sort of wool. So they say, we want your good wool, which is a specific grade, and we'll pay 15 marks per sack. And medium wool, we want 10 marks per sack. Now, just look at the bottom, a mark is actually a unit in the medieval world, which was 13 shillings and 4 pence. So a D means pence, as in a denarii. Okay, it's a silver penny, a denarii. And those old enough, Colin probably remembers, they had this currency until about 1971, I think, or something. I'm too young, I can't remember. I only remember modern currencies. I can't remember pounds, shilling and pence. I was calling it P once and I got told off, but it's pounds, shillings and pence. So there was 12 pennies to a shilling, 240 pennies to a pound, 20 shillings to a pound. I think that's right, but I don't know because I can't remember. But Colin will confirm that later. He's probably still got some old coins to show us. Yeah. And then a mark was a unit of 13 shillings and 4 pence. So they dealt in marks for some reason. We don't really know why they dealt in marks. I think it might be something to do with it being like a euro. You know, today we've got the euro. It may have been an early form of euro. It meant something to the medieval people. They understood in Italy and France what a mark was quite easily, and that's why they used it, because it seems like an odd sum, doesn't it? 13 shillings and 4 pence. And as I said earlier, the sack was about 26 stones at 14 pounds to the stone, which is, again, as I said, 165 kilograms. Now, the payment itself was in advance, so they'd get the money in two halves, 60 at the beginning, 60 at the end, and then the remainder on the delivery of the wool. Okay, so that's what a standard contract looked like. That's how it was structured. Who got involved in these contracts? Well, in England, it's monastic producers mainly, as you can see. When I say lay producer, I mean a non-monastic person, so a person like you and me, okay, as a lay producer, a layman, someone who's not involved in the church. A monastic producer, as you can see, there's got 113 contracts for over 4,000 sacks of wool, whereas the lay producers have got a lot of contracts, 100 contracts, but very little wool in comparison to the monastic producers. And then these different houses are different religious houses that were around in England in the Middle Ages. So the Cistercians were the big major wool producer, but we also get producers in the Augustinians, Benedictines, etc. And even the Knights Templar those who've watched Dan Brown's films and books will have come across the Knights Templar. Yeah, you've come across those, Tom Hanks, etc. So the Knights Templar were even involved in this, so it must have had something to do with the Holy Grail, etc. Now, the Cistercians, interestingly enough, why did they get into this market? They didn't get into it through choice. They got into it because they were late in the game. In England, all the best land went to the Augustinians because they were early. They were early monks, and they got all the best land. When the Cistercians came about, the king didn't have any good land left. So he gave them all the rubbish land, all the what we call the marginal land. Marginal meaning hilly. You know, you can't grow crops on. And the Cistercians thought to themselves, what can we do with this? I know, sheep love marginal land. And so they invested in sheep. And funnily enough, they became the richest monastic house in England due to an accident that they got all the rubbish land. Yeah, so they couldn't grow crops. But they thought, we can grow wool. Okay, so the Cistercians are the biggest growers in England. Now they grew, what did they do with all their money? Well, they built, I don't know if you can see that again, but they built these huge monasteries. Okay, this one's Fountains Abbey in Yorkshire. And you can visit it today if you want to. You see some people there. It's not my picture on my holiday snaps. But these are massive buildings. These really are big. They really are a wonder of the world. You know, how did they build these big buildings? But that's another lecture. But these are massive buildings. And they survive all over England. So there's lots of broken down monasteries all over England when you go and visit. But this is a Cistercian house in Fountains in Yorkshire. And this is what they did with all the money. This is why they wanted the money. They wanted the money so they could build big monasteries for the glory of God, to bring awe to the people around and to sort of demonstrate, as I say, the glory of God on earth. So that's why they wanted the money in advance, so they could build these big things. They were cash poor, as we say. They were very much asset rich. They had all this wool, but they had no money. So that's why they wanted the money. They were cash poor, asset rich, and they wanted their cash now, so that's why they sold their wool in the future. Does anyone know why these monasteries are all broken down? No? No, I mean, in other countries, we've still got monasteries, haven't we? We've got France, etc. In England, you don't have them. They're all smashed to pieces like this. And it's all because of Henry VIII, because he wanted to get married again. But you might have, I won't go into that. But he fell out with the Pope because the Pope wouldn't let him marry again. And so he decided to leave the Pope, leave the Catholic Church, and make his own church, the Church of England, and then he destroyed all the monasteries, okay, in the 1500s. So that's why they're all destroyed and not together like they are in other parts of the world.